Welcome to the Upper Hand Podcast, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all things hand surgery related, from technical to personal.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And thank you in advance for leaving a review and leaving a rating wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck, how are you?
I'm quite well. It feels like it's been a minute.
It has been. Well, welcome to 2023. I know that we had a podcast, we took a week off last week, and then we had an episode that came out beforehand. I don't know if the listeners picked up that was recorded before the new year.
I don't know. We have savvy listeners. I don't think you give them enough credit, Dr. D.
Yeah, we can't get one past them. So yeah, welcome to 2023.
Yeah, it's off to a good start. How was your holiday season?
Well, you know, we were supposed to go to Estes Park, Colorado for a little family trip. And then I'm sure many of our listeners also got caught up in the whole Southwest cancellation snafu, more than a snafu. So our trip was canceled and we decided to take an alternate route. And because we were supposed to travel with my family from Florida, and nobody was flying anywhere, we drove and met them halfway in your former hometown of Birmingham, Alabama.
I was so excited to hear that you went to see my birthplace. How was Birmingham?
You know what? We had a fun time. So we're not skiers, so it was just going to be mainly like hanging out inside anyway, to be honest with you, with some snow activities for the kids. So we got to do all those things, minus the snow activities, but in warmer weather. So, you know, the kids had a good time with their cousins and, you know, me and my wife and my sisters and my brother-in-law. We had a good time. So there was some cooking. There was a fair. We ate our way through Birmingham. I've got a bunch of spots, some of which you recommended, others of which we branched out a bit from. And we had a really good time.
So you were not staying in Birmingham Central, and is the Birmingham that I recall got rural pretty quick outside the city limits.
We were in was it Mountain Brook? Is that that's where you recommended? So we were in Mountain Brook, and I was talking to somebody, and they asked where we were staying, and I told them, and they said, "Oh, wouldn't walk around outside there."
That's why you got such a good deal on that Airbnb.
Yeah, well, it was a last minute Airbnb. So yeah, we had a really good time. It was a wonderful place. The kids had a good time. We had fun. All good. How was your holiday?
We also were struck by Southwest, although it all worked out. We were going to go to California for 5 days just to, you know, get out of town, get the kids together and have them a little bit captive. And Jake made it out no problem flying from New York, and the rest of us got our flight canceled. We lost 2 days, but we still were, you know, we only ended up being there for 2.5 days, but we kind of had to go because Jake was there, and it was fun. It was a great time. Highlighted by some time spent with our wonderful fellow David Wright and his family, and it's kind enough to take us out in a tour of San Diego Bay on his beautiful boat. So that was definitely a highlight. The kids loved
it. That's awesome. That sounds great. Yeah, I saw the picture, and I also heard from a birdie that David may have hosted Jake for Christmas dinner.
Yeah. Well, yes, Talia had a great trip plan, and Jake got out there on Christmas Eve, and we did not. And David was kind enough to invite him over, and even his family even gave him a nice gift.
Wow, I thought it was going to be like the Plaza from Home Alone, where Jake was just sitting there eating room service, watching movies. But I guess he's a little older than that.
Well, we joked about that because he was in a nice spot, and there are worse places to be stuck alone.
I'm sure that his accommodations were adequate.
Yes, for sure. I'm sure your practice didn't slow down on the holidays at all, because mine was out of control.
Yeah, our friends from overseas are going to laugh at the American healthcare system, but the end of the year, I met my deductible, suddenly urgent carpal tunnel situation, and many other chronic conditions. That became real. I started hearing that refrain in September, as I'm sure you did too. And for many proceduralists or surgeons in the U.S., it's a very busy November, December, and maybe an exhale in January.
Yeah, mine's carried over a little bit into January. I feel like I still haven't caught up, but it's good. It's a nice way to end the year, but nice to take a few days off as well.
Oh man. Well, you know, I've got the Monday, Friday clinic schedule, and because of the way the holidays fell this year, I paid a substantial penalty. So every clinic in January thus far has been absolutely bonkers with patients. You know, and it's been busy. But busy is good. A lot of learning. As the resident that I'm working with now said, a lot of learning and learning quickly. So
it's the truth. Good. So a little teaser, I think maybe next episode, I don't want to lock us in, but I'd love to talk some about the adolescent elbow, which hopefully would appeal to a wide audience. As I've mentioned on this podcast, it's remarkable to me what I am seeing as someone who, I don't even know if my name is out there as an adolescent elbow person, but I do a ton of it, and it increasing complexity of challenges. So I'd love to share some thoughts and pick your brain just on kind of developing a somewhat of a niche practice. Is I've always had a niche practice in other areas, but not this. So it could be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, no, I think it's amazing. That's a practice niche that did not exist even as recently ago as when I was in training, which was probably just like 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But that didn't exist, and that was not, quote, a thing. And I think that, you know, it'll be interesting to hear you talk through how that's developed for you and where you envision that going. While you clearly have developed a niche in other areas, including, you know, congenital and pediatric hand, and as well as the sports practice in general, I think the landscape has changed, and something that's even as hyper-focused as adolescent elbow, you know, it'll be different to try to develop that in 2023 and beyond.
No, that's exactly right. Today we have a great topic, but maybe before we jump in, we should thank our sponsors.
Yes, The Upper Hand is sponsored by PracticeLink.com. Yes, they are still sponsoring us. The most widely used physician job search and career advancement resource. Becoming a physician is hard. Finding the right job doesn't have to be.
Join PracticeLink for free today at www.practicelink.com/theupperhand. So it is a service they provide, which is really interesting. And after speaking to some of our residents, there's no easy resource. And so maybe it's an option for some. And hopefully I'm not looking for a job anytime soon, but just in case.
Yeah, you never know. You know, I think that at the very least it's somewhere to start and how to start thinking about the questions to ask as you look at offers. And so much of that market is, I think, is still highly, unregulated. So putting some structure around it and knowing how to approach a process is good. And apparently you have to use this link, otherwise we will not get credit. So
yeah, please go often and spend time at this link.
And hit refresh and log into many VPNs from different countries.
It's actually interesting. We probably could have an interesting episode talking about job search, because I've learned a lot. Not necessarily because of this relationship, but just it is a really interesting process.
For sure. Hearing our residents and fellows go through it, I think you pick up pearls about how the process has changed and honestly how individual it is. But I think that having having an understanding of how to think about it even and where to start, I think can be very useful.
Yeah, and when to start. You had a good idea for a topic today, which may end up being a two-parter, but we thought we would jump in. And why don't you want to start by telling us about a case?
Well, yeah. I mean, so I saw a patient with advanced ulnar neuropathy, and this was, you know, the completely burnt out and cold ulnar nerve. So no way of salvaging that with any transposition and supercharge. And, you know, there was not a substantial pain component. So you really were left with a functional issue of a claw hand, and the classic claw hand. And, you know, I think that thinking about the claw hand was always really challenging to me, because I didn't see that patient as a resident very often. And I saw some of it as a fellow, but I think that what you see as a fellow in clinic and in the OR is very subject to waves in practice and, you know, who's coming in on what day. Some of it's very random. So, you know, I didn't get a lot of exposure to thinking about the claw hand. You know, but then I read this great article by a young Dr. Goldfarb when he was in training with Peter Stern that was published in the now defunct Journal of the American Society for Surgery of the Hand.
I love that. I feel some pride in having published in, but not contributed to, the end of a journal, which was a review journal. Arnold Peter Weiss really led that effort. It was a very good journal. I'm not sure exactly why it's no longer present, but that was that review article on Lowell and nerve palsy really had a good deal of information in it. And there's not a lot new. So 20 years ago, it was about the same as it is today. Actually, maybe even worse.
I mean, I think that that review article somehow advanced the field. I don't know how it did. But it's been disseminated as part of the Stern Classic Readings in the folder there. So I think a lot of people have read it, and for good reason. It's a really good article. And what I love about it is it very clearly breaks down the reasons for a claw. On top of that, it goes into all of the physical examination findings that that are commonly discussed. So, you know, I think it is a really solid read for any medical student, resident, fellow, hand therapist who wants a fundamental understanding. Because I think you can build a lot of knowledge after you've read that article.
Or attending, who doesn't see this very often. And I think that's most of us. You know, and I'd love to go into detail. I recently have been treating a family with Charcot-Marie-Tooth. And they present like ulnar nerve, chronic ulnar nerve. And it's really fascinating to see them and think about it. It's the same situation. How do you reconstruct them to improve their function, especially when you're not dealing with pain and you're not going to recover sensations intact for this group? So it's the same conversation, just with a very specialized group.
So, I mean, I think that one of the challenging parts about just, you know, these complex patients and in this aspect nerve is just trying to break down what's going on and what needs to be done. And I think that, you know, I was seeing a run of complex, like kind of weird cervical radiculopathy, double crush kind of patients in clinic the other day. And I was reminded of the quote, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. So you got to start somewhere, right? So no, this was not going to be a cooking reference, but so I think that understanding the lesion and then understanding what drives the lesion from a purely anatomic or physiologic perspective, and then figuring out what you can do to functionally make a difference is the way to go.
And understanding what each patient is bothered by. And that'll be an interesting part of this conversation. So how do you want to start?
Well, I mean, I think that maybe you could tell us a bit about, you know, why if in the classic isolated ulnar neuropathy patient, why they get a claw deformity, you know, so what's going on at each of the joints. Because if you break it down at that level, then I think the rest of the process of treating it follows.
Yeah, I think really in simplistically, you lose the function of the intrinsic muscles of the hand. And that includes the interossei and the lumbricals, especially ulnar side of interossei, but that varies from patient to patient. And essentially what we're talking about is you're losing the extension of the PIP joints. The way I think about it, and you may think about it differently, and this is just me processing the visual, is when you lose your ability to actively extend the IP joints, and again, mainly the PIP joint, your body attempts to compensate and you end up overfiring your extrinsic extensors, your EDCs and your extensor digiti minimi. And over time, especially in some more lax individuals, you get marked hyperextension of the ring and little finger especially, and then you get a flexion posture of your ring and little and maybe your middle fingers. So that's the simplistic overview on the ulnar side of the hand. What did I miss?
No, I mean, obviously that's it, right? I mean, you wrote the article, right? So, but I think it is the absence of ulnar intrinsic function in the setting of maintained radial extrinsic extension of the fingers. So you still have something that is going to try to pull on both the MP and PIP joints into extension, the radial nerve with the EDP or EDC, the EDM and the EIP. But you lack the ulnar nerve intrinsic function of flexing the MP joints and extending the PIP and the DIP. So you have an imbalance now. And, you know, I think one of the key, so that's the straightforward one where you don't have any crazy radial nerve involvement. And then the thumb I want to leave for a separate discussion, because I think that's a little bit harder to tackle. So if you have somebody that's got clawing, first off, when you see the patient, I think one of the important things to check for is maintenance of supple joints. So making sure that this is a passively correctable claw deformity, because I think it becomes a much harder issue to deal with if things are not passively correctable.
And that's our job, and I'm sure Macy would educate us both, but that's our job as physicians and therapists, is early recognition in the setting of trauma. So if there's a gunshot wound to a more proximal ulnar nerve, for example, even if you supercharge a reconstruction, I think you have to act as if you expect there to be a risk for claw. And I do two things in those patients. One, I ask therapy to educate on passive extension to not lose it. And two, I use some type of lumbrical bar to keep the MP joints flexed, which allows the patient to actively extend the IP joints. So those are my two early steps, early intervention.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree with that. And, you know, that mention of the lumbrical bar is very helpful because, you know, that flexion of the MP joints is an important concept to understand in terms of your options for correction of a claw deformity. So in a claw deformity, as you've mentioned, I'm just going to say it differently just in case people are going to hear it differently too. Your MP joints want to extend, and then your PIP and DIP joints essentially want to flex, and especially for the ring and small finger. So what you've got to do to try to get those ring and small fingers into extension at the PIJ in particular is get those MP joints into flexion. And I think that's the biggest thing to assess, you know, and the physical exam maneuver that I like the most is the Bouvier maneuver. And that's where you hold the MP joints in flexion, and then you ask the patient to straighten their fingers. And to me, it's a big decision node there, whether they can straighten or extend their PIP joint if the MP joint is held in flexion. Did I summarize that correctly?
You did. I think that's important to understand as a clinician, not only because it helps you better process and discuss with the patient, but frankly, it drives the surgical decision-making process as well.
Right. So what's your decision-making process? I mean, so you think about all of the different things you could do with the underlying principle of wanting to get the MP joints into flexion with the goal of using the extrinsic extensors to then drive PIP extension. How do you think about different ways to get that done?
Well, the first, in my mind, the first step is how do you control the MP joints? So there's two issues. One, control the MP joints. And for some patients, that's sufficient. And then the second decision making is, do you want to try to power PIP extension? So if the Bouvier test is positive, meaning they can't do that, then you have to decide, do I want to try to power finger IP joint extension? And do I want to use a classic finger flexor to do that? Or do I want to use another muscle group altogether, like the ECRB or ECRL extended with a four-tail graft? And so those are, I think that's it really for the ulnar side of the hand reconstruction. Those are the decisions.
Right, exactly. So if you do the Bouvier maneuver and the MP joints are held in flexion and you're able to get active extension of the PIP joint, do you think that that's enough to rely on holding the MP joint in flexion and go with what is called, many would call, a static kind of transfer? And do you think that the only indication for a dynamic type transfer is if you don't get active extension of the PIP joint with the Bouvier maneuver, MP joints held in flexion?
So I certainly am rapidly becoming one of the elderly senior statesmen in the hand world, in the sense that I've been doing this 20 years now. And I'm at a big tertiary quaternary type referral center, but no one does a lot of this. No one. And leprosy taught us a great deal about this problem, but those surgeons are just not around anymore. So no one has a huge personal experience. My personal belief is that I really do still like a capsulodesis, but I don't think it's sufficient because it will stretch out over time in most patients. I don't believe in bony blocks or some of the other historical things. To me, it's very simple. Nothing simple, but you do. I do a volar capsulodesis, and essentially through the same incision, I add a Zancoli lasso. How do you think about it?
So, I mean, the principle is to keep the MP joint in flexion, and there are a number of different ways to do that. And you've listed a couple of them. The first way to get the MP joint flexed would be to, as you're talking about, advance the MP joint volar capsule. And in advancing that, that's going to hold the MP joint in flexion. Another way to do that would be to intentionally bowstring at and essentially do an aggressive release of A1 and A2 in order to get MP joint flexion. And that could be done in combination with the capsulodesis. And then you mentioned, I might be missing something else, but you mentioned one of the other ones, which is the Zancoli FDS lasso, in which you find the FDS tendon slips as they insert distally or wherever you choose to take them, release them distally so they're no longer flexing the PIP joint. And there are a number of different ways to do this, but then loop them back on top of themselves. So you've got them on top of the A1 and A2 pulleys, volar to the A1 and A2 pulleys, and then sutured back to itself proximal to the A1 pulley. Can you think of any other static kind of procedures that would hold the MP joint in flexion?
No, those are the main ones. I historically, people put a bone block in the joint. I mean, you can fuse the joint if you want, but that doesn't make any sense to me. So I think, in my mind, you've summarized it very nicely, including the technique. And I think there are different ways to do the Zancoli lasso, but they're all about the same in my mind, whether you go over A1 and A2 or different ways to do it. But accomplish the same goal, a dynamic transfer that when the patient fires, tends to flex the MP, and they may be able to extend the IP joint more easily, therefore.
Wait a minute, you mean a static transfer? This is statically holding the MP joints in flexion, right?
The capsulodesis, but the Zancoli adds the dynamic component when they're pulling on their FDS.
Oh, okay, gotcha. That's okay. I see what you're saying. And then when do you think that the volar capsulodesis is enough? Because, you know, whenever I've done that, I've been unimpressed with the amount of correction and the maintenance of correction. And I don't know whether I'm fooling myself.
Yeah, it's hard. I don't know the perfect population. I would say a bit of an older patient, maybe with a more robust volar plate. Now, those are the patients that may not get so much hypertension, the MP, if they have a really like a burly type worker, may not get as much MP joint hypertension. But the flip side is if they do get some, they have a more substantial volar plate to work with. It's the same question we deal with when we're talking about the thumb CMC joint. Like, how do you control the MP joint of the thumb in a straightforward way? And is capsulodesis enough? So I don't know the answer, but I do like it because it immediately places the MP joint in flexion. It's one more check. And I think in general, supplementing it with something else makes sense.
You know, first of all, I don't want to gloss over a really good point that you made. The big working hand tends not to get a claw just because the MP joints tend to be tight and they tend to have a bit of an MP joint contracture, which stops them from going into this. You know, if you have more laxity, you're more prone to get into this hyperextended MP posture. And I remember reading, when I was a resident, reading the chapter on ulnar neuropathy in Green's operative hand surgery, talking about how the ulnar nerve is a luxury to the laborer. And for a number of reasons, but one of them being that, you know, the clawing just doesn't happen as much in that big burly hand. Now, that is clearly an overgeneralization, but it's a good concept to think about.
Absolutely. And it's fact. I mean, you'll see it in your clinic and you worry less about that worker with an ulnar nerve injury than you do with a 15-year-old adolescent female. It's just different right. Population.
So then I think we're going to have another episode on this because we're probably running close to time. But, you know, do you ever pin the MP joints to keep them in the flex position temporarily?
I am absolutely not against pinning. I've pinned less and less fingers in these situations, whether it be the PIP joint after release or the MP joint in this situation. I think, again, if you have substantial volar plate to work with and you feel comfortable with your capsulodesis and you can capture a dorsal splint to block extension, I am comfortable not pinning. But the flip side is also true. If you need to pin, you pin. And you know what? You pin for 6 weeks and they're going to get stiff.
So we'll talk about the technical aspects of the Zancoli as well as other dynamic transfers when we meet again. But when you have somebody in whom you've done a volar capsulodesis alone, and advanced it, and you've gotten them in good position, What's your post-op protocol for that? And are you also intentionally bowstringing at the same time?
I always release, obviously, A1 because that's your access point to the volar plate. I've not done that. It's a smart trick. I've not tried it. Meaning, and I think what would be required would be to release A1 and A2. I haven't done that. I might consider it in the future. I think for me, this volar plate capsulodesis would, again, be A, the right patient, and B, the right injury. I wouldn't do that in a Charcot Marie tooth patient or in a chronic ulnar nerve that we're not hoping recovers. But if it is a younger patient with an ulnar nerve repair plus minus supercharge that had been clawing prior to surgical intervention where you were hopeful for recovery, I think that's the perfect patient to do a capsulodesis alone, because if your nerve regeneration works, you're not going to need it.
Do you think that down the line that, you know, having, I think, do you think it'll stretch out and with enough time that it'll coincide with your eventual recovery of intrinsic function that you amazingly get?
Absolutely. It's always perfect timing.
Well done. Well done. Now, and then I guess before I forget to ask, technically, how do you secure your advanced capsule?
Yeah, I tend to take a segment out of the volar plate, and I don't use suture anchors, although again, not against them, but I take a wedge segment out of the volar plate, flex the finger, and use a pretty substantial, like a 2-0 braided non-absorbable suture to bring the edges of the volar plate back together. That's part one. Part two is immobilization for 6 weeks.
Now, was that very hard for you not to say the brand name of that suture you just described?
I don't know why I didn't say the brand name. You always seem to correct me when I do. And B, it was very hard to say it that way.
I like to use a generic suture anchor because that's what I saw in the limited portions that I saw in training. I probably like to spend more money than you.
Maybe you do. So when you do that, you put the suture anchor in the base of the proximal phalanx. Do you excise any of the volar plate, or you just use that suture anchor to grab some of the volar plate?
So I put the anchor in the metacarpal and use that at the kind of the neck region, because I think you're getting dicey the further out you go. And then use the braided non-absorbable suture and essentially crack out one limb up and then bring that same limb down and then hold the MP joint down. And I think that if you're limited in terms of if you don't have anybody that can hold it, or, you know, usually you're the attending and you're flexing the MP joint down and somebody else is doing the stitch, that can be a very tight area to put a stitch in and also to slide that knot properly, which can lead to some points of frustration. So sometimes it is more helpful just to at least provisionally pin the joint, which I try not to pin if I don't have to. And then I also think, well, if I've got it pinned, why not just leave it pinned? But if I can avoid pinning it, I avoid pinning it. If I need to, just from a logistical perspective, I will. And then just really, this is the knot where the knot tying skills matter, and sliding that knot all the way down and securing it properly. It holds really well. I'm very happy with that. It's just obviously, like anything, will stretch over time.
I think we need to create a new scale, and we'll call it the F-bomb generating scale of procedures. This would be high on the list of generating F-bombs, because you have a relatively small area you're working in. You have the flexor tendons in your way. You're trying to retract the flexor tendons, keep the MP flex, put some sutures in, and look smooth doing it. And I'm sure you do, Dr. D, but I let them fly during that case.
I'm just going to say that this is an excellent time to reinforce knot tying skills. So yes, we can go into more detail about other aspects. I think probably we need to alternate and, you know, let you have your adolescent elbow moment next, and then we'll get back to different types of tendon transfers for anti-claw. So we'll alternate nerve-ish and sports.
I like that. I would also, for those of you who have made it to the end of this episode, my request would be send us your F-bomb generating cases. I think those will be good fodder for discussion. I may even email the group to ask for those cases.
This, look at this, 2023 and a new lesson of listener engagement. So thank you to those of you who have made it to the end. And now that you know Chuck's pearls for F-bomb generating cases.
Perfect. I love it. Good to see you, Chris. Have a good long weekend.
You too.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is @congenitalhand. What about you?
Mine is at ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.